Welcome to the PreparedX Podcast, your complete source for crisis, emergency, business continuity, and security preparedness interviews, news, and much more. Now, your host, he creates chaos for a living, Rob Burton.
Hello, and welcome to episode 49 of the PreparedX Podcast. Before I get started, as you know, PreparedX are sponsoring the International Crisis Management Conference in Boston on April 25th, 2018, which is literally right around the corner here. We'll have a booth there, so come along if you're at the conference and say hi. If you're not attending the conference or you're not aware of the conference, then go to crisisconferences.com to find out more information. And there's just a few days left here before the conference is starting, so hopefully you can make it to the conference. If not this year, then next year. It's a great event. So in this podcast, which I can't believe it's episode 49 already, I interview Jared Goff, who is a captain and executive officer at the Fairfax County Fire and Rescue Department. He's also a graduate of the Naval Postgraduate School Center for Homeland Defense and Security. We had a great conversation. Jared did a lot of research and work around complex coordinated attacks, which are challenging for government responders. I got talking to him about how businesses can prepare for these types of events if they feel they need to. We spoke about extensively about the 2008 Mumbai attacks, which is a great example of a complex coordinated attack, and what were the key findings that came out of that. So Jared had some great information on that. We also touched on, of course, as we always do, exercises and how organizations can prepare themselves working with first responders, be it this type of event or other types of events. So anyway, enough of me. Here's my interview with Jared Goff. Good morning, Jared. How are you doing today?
I'm doing well, Rob. How are you?
I'm great, thank you. Thanks for joining us. And just as we get started here for our listeners, if you could introduce yourself and just talk for a few minutes about your career, please.
Yes, sir. Well, good morning to the listeners. My name is Jared Goff. I'm currently a Captain 2 with the Fairfax County Fire and Rescue Department, which is located in Northern Virginia. My primary assignment right now, I'm an executive officer for one of our three assistant fire chiefs. I have about 20 years within Fairfax County Fire and Rescue Department, 25 years total within the Fire and Rescue and Emergency Services. In the last 10 years, I've been primarily involved in leadership, command, and field training type of positions. One of my notable positions that I really like to talk about is when I was assigned as a regional intelligence officer in our local fusion center, where I was responsible for the collection, analysis, development, and dissemination of a variety of intelligence, as well as collaborating with not only state and local first responders, but also the private sector within public health and hospitals, as well as law enforcement. In addition to that, just recently, I was selected as the deputy program manager for our Northern Virginia High Threat Response Group, which is derived out of a complex coordinated attack grant sponsored by the Federal Emergency Management Agency. Where I'll be assisting with the management of the grant, policy development, training requirements, and probably most notable is fostering what we call the whole of community collaboration between state and locals and the private sector. And I'll talk a little bit about that during the presentation.
Excellent. That's excellent. Sorry, go ahead.
My degrees I'm very proud of. I just earned a master's degree from the Naval Postgraduate School Center for Homeland Defense and Security. My thesis is primarily looking at the challenges that our first responders face when preparing for these complex coordinated attacks. And my previous master's degree is from Norwich University, where my concentration was international terrorism.
Very cool. Very cool. Great background and congrats there on all of that in terms of your career to date. Sounds like you've been super busy on all fronts. As you've stated there, let's start out with a brief explanation on for our listeners, some are overseas, as you're probably familiar with, and may be familiar with the term complex coordinated attack. Others may be closer to home and may not understand that term. So could you just explain what is a complex coordinated attack?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I actually struggled with this throughout my research, but just a quick background, the question in itself actually requires a complex answer. So CCA, or complex coordinated attacks, so I'll use CCA throughout the podcast here, was originally used in the tech field as a way to explain a way in which hackers could attack specific networks. Somehow, somewhere, really undefined, that was merged into the actual terrorist attack cycle. And really since Mumbai, which I'll explain later, and other attacks, the terms kind of morph into a variety of explanations, primarily by either the media, federal or state government, and scholars alike. But there's really no one definition. However, I guess for the purposes of the discussion here, I'll provide kind of two theories or ideas about what a complex coordinated attack is. So our FEMA defines it as a threat that involves a synchronized, independent teams at multiple locations, with little no warning, employing one or more weapon systems such as firearms, explosives, fire, or other non-traditional attack methodologies, which are intended to result in scores of casualties. Other federal agencies such as the National Counterterrorism Center, as well as the FBI, have a little more watered-down version, which I tend to go with, which is a coordinated assault of one or more locations in close succession, initiated after little no warning, employing one or more of the following, which is firearms, explosives, and arson. So what of this problem is that, you know, the complexity aspect is how we, the victims, view the problem. It's not that, you know, the terrorists are looking at this and say, we have to do a complex coordinated attack. It's how we view it. So broken down into the parts of the sum, the problem space is relatively simple. What we're talking about here is the use of firearms, fire or arson, improvised explosive devices, and other non-traditional, relatively easy to obtain weapons, such as large vehicles or knives or those types of things.
Sure. Excellent. So again, I think we, you know, some parts of the world are, you know, again, familiar with this. You know, we've seen attacks, you know, somewhat recently in the last few years in Europe, where there's been, you know, multiple groups or multiple individuals within a location. I think Paris and Brussels, and you know, there's others that have happened in London. Actually, a number of those attacks have happened in London over the last few years. So, as it relates to the North America scene, what are the chances of these events happening here?
That's another really good question. So my thesis and my research suggests that a CCA by true definition is a low frequency but high risk type of attack. Nationally, and I think it's arguable that the chances, the historical piece of the occurrence within the United States is nil. Of course, 9/11 could, you know, we could argue that piece of it, but based upon the definition, the chances are extremely low. Why? Of course, no one really knows. But, you know, since 2004, there's been at least one CCA or CCA-type incident per year. You know, we could start back in 1983 with Beirut, Madrid, London, Mumbai, of course, the U.S. consulate in Pakistan, 2015 in Paris, and then, of course, 2016 Brussels Airport. Now, again, these don't necessarily fall into the buckets of the complex coordinated attack definition, but they're certainly very similar, and certainly we can have a great discussion and learn from takeaways from these type of incidents.
Yeah, great. And there's one I want to touch on. I know in your thesis, you mentioned Mumbai, which was, I think, 2008. And there's obviously a lot of information out there with regards to that. It was obviously at the time one of those events that happened, and it was essentially streamed live. I remember watching it over a few days. So, you know, could you just, you know, for our listeners who may be not familiar with Mumbai and the attack that took place there, if you could just, you know, give us an overview of what happened over those few days, and specifically, you know, what were the challenges that the first responders faced with, and you know, the lessons that came out of the other end? So it's a bit of a meaty question, but I guess, you know, Mumbai is a perfect example. Would you not agree?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. As a matter of fact, the 2008 Mumbai attack is really considered by first responders and the intelligence community as the optimal blueprint for a complex coordinated attack. So for the listeners, just a brief overview, and I should say prior to this that, you know, you can really use any part of social media or YouTube to look at this event. There's a lot of really good footage and a lot of really good documentaries that have been done on this incident. But essentially, this was a bona fide terrorist attack funded by Lashkar-e-Taiba, which is a known Pakistani terrorist group. Prior to the event, you know, it had some key indicators related to suspicious activity, including surveillance and testing of security. Those were conducted, ironically, by an American citizen. On November 26th, when they struck, there was 10 terrorist members. They arrived in Mumbai via a fishing vessel that they captured, essentially. The group split into five teams of two. The selected targets in advance included a major train station, a cafe frequented by Westerners, two major hotels, two taxis, and a Jewish center. These terrorists were armed with automatic weapons and explosives. The attackers conducted a four-day attack cycle, essentially resulted in 168 dead and over 300 wounded. So it was a significant attack. The piece that was televised, at least that got the most attention, I'd say, is the attack on the Taj Mahal. And part of the reason it got a lot of immediate attention was because the terrorists lit numerous fires, which was directed by their handler, Pakistan. And this essentially drew additional attention by media sources to the actual attack cycle. But also from a tactical piece of it, it's assumed that this tactic was to delay law enforcement from gaining access to the building or to actually take them out. First responders were challenged in many ways. This attack cycle took place over 3 days, and very, very little of what we do unless it's a disaster, you know, was very much mitigated within a few hours, if not minutes. And it also occurred at multiple sites. So, you know, looking at it from the outside in, from the rearview mirror, essentially, the emergency services were confused, overwhelmed, understaffed, under-equipped, and really lacked the training experience to handle such an incident. Not to mention, you know, law enforcement was equipped with, you know, World War II era rifles, and the fire service were operating in hostile environments where they're actually being shot at or dealing with firearms were close to them. The lessons learned from this are many. As a matter of fact, I read some reports still that come out that I learned some information about, but, you know, we had the luxury of looking at this from a 2020 perspective. And, you know, as troublesome as they may be, we can learn from these mistakes and misfortunes and obviously translate that not only to state and local public safety, but also to our businesses, the private sector. And I'll just hit on five real quick, five, you know, lessons learned. You know, first is intelligence failures. The Indian intelligence knew about these warnings, or at least had information that these warnings were there, but they lacked specificity, which prevented a response or action. The suspicious activity reporting piece that I talked on earlier, you know, there were people that saw these 10 terrorists come off of a fishing boat. They were engaged by local fishermen, and the terrorists told them to mind their own business. That information never made it to the local police department, which is actually very troubling.
Yep.
The target hardening piece of it is obviously difficult, but the train stations there were soft targets, as are ours. Pretty much many train stations across the world are still soft. They lack the unified collaborative response, which is a big deal, particularly for the private sector, to engage with the local government forces. And lastly, I'll just touch on the equipment. Again, it was old. Just a quick point here. The police had a 303 bolt-action rifle, 5mm thick plastic riot shields, and World War II era helmets. So they were ill-prepared and outmatched for a team of 10 trained terrorists.
Yeah, I visited Mumbai and actually went down to the Taj Hotel there a number of years after the event. I was down there on business, and it's a bustling, very dynamic city. You know, tight city in terms of, you know, it's not that open. And it seems to me that the way they came in on those vessels was, you know, again, well planned out, because, you know, that allowed them access to the almost open front there to the city. So, very interesting case for anyone interested in looking back at it. There's obviously a lot of information out there. So great information there, Jared. So as it relates to, as you know, most of our consumers are businesses. So, you know, in terms of preparing their organizations for such events, I know you mentioned one of your roles is, you know, working with obviously state and local partners as well as the private sector. Obviously, it seems to me that government would be responsible, obviously, in those initial minutes, hours, or days, as you've mentioned, Mumbai there, in the response to these types of attacks. But surely businesses should make employees aware of their surroundings, and what else can they do in terms of preparing their employees to report such behavior?
Yeah, so you're absolutely correct, and local businesses do play an important role in any type of emergency within their community. And there's really basically three major pillars that I'd like to share with you that should be considered by businesses. The first is kind of twofold. First is to really train employees on suspicious activity reporting. And going back to the Mumbai piece, you know, there was a lot of photography, which may not be abnormal for major cities, but I think it's the type of photography or the way that, that photographs are being taken of specific buildings. And also what to do with that information. There's plenty of resources online, the Nationwide Suspicious Activity Initiative, that you can get. You can reach out to your local police department or your local fusion center if they're published and get that training. It's highly important. I mean, you are a critical infrastructure it's in many cases, and identifying those pieces of suspicious activity that need to be reported, maybe that dot, if you will, that may help with either a case or maybe to actually thwart an incident. There are known cases of suspicious activity reporting that has been collected by the police department or Federal Bureau of Investigations that has actually helped cases. And the second piece of that is there's a new initiative out there by FEMA, and there might be some similar initiatives. I know Paris has a similar initiative called Be the Help, and that's essentially training non-first responders on how to stop the bleeding, how to turn gas off, how to do a variety of things that may be impacted by your building systems, but primarily this is Be the Help in stopping the bleeding, to stop the dying. Clearly, in these type of incidents, if they are as widespread, the resources are going to be thin, and the hope is that local business will be able to assist in keeping people alive and keeping their area safe. So you can certainly use any search engine to search those two pieces there. And I know with the suspicious activity piece, that's a global initiative as well. The second thing is really develop a plan for your employees should you need to relocate and or communicate during a crisis. Those two pieces, not only from the relocating, but also communicating during a crisis. And the important part of that is when the local first responders arrive to a building, especially if your building's impacted, we're gonna try to account for your people to make sure there's either no one in the building or no one is unaccounted for, which if everyone is accounted for and you have that plan, then obviously our workload then is decreased significantly. So this can be applied during not only regional emergencies, but those that actually affect your business. So your local emergency management agency should be able to help out with that. And obviously, there's also some great resources through a variety of emergency management agencies across the globe. And thirdly, I would say, engage with your local emergency services leaders now. Talk to them, invite them over. Tell them about your concerns, your gaps, your needs, your barriers to achieve a level of preparedness and resiliency, particularly. You can offer and share your contingency plan, your communications plan, or even things that you can do to aid in the situation should a specific incident arise. And why? Well, I know the private sector generally is not viewed as a piece of our critical infrastructure, whereas they really are from not only from a financial standpoint, but also you're part of the community. So you are an integral piece, not only to information sharing, but also incident management. So that is perhaps not traditional, asymmetrical, But realistically, if the emergency is in or around your business, you may actually be part of the incident management team.
Yeah, we're seeing that a lot more now, certainly up here in Rhode Island. You know, there's a lot of private partnerships with the emergency management agency that I'm hearing about, and they try and get the community involved as much as possible. So, you know, great 3 points you made there, Jared, and you know, one in particular that you know is close to you know what I used to do in a former life as it relates to security and in the military is that period of surveillance that always precedes these types of events. And, you know, if we can identify, you know, what's going on, if we can report that up the chain of command, and sometimes that has to be, you know, rushed through, and sometimes, you know, you're not heard as a private citizen. So that's always a challenge as well. But there's always a period of surveillance. I was doing an interview recently with a former colleague of mine, and, you know, we were talking about a number of the events over in Europe, and he does an after action for most of these events that goes out. He has, basically an intelligence report that goes out. And, you know, part of it is always to look at that those periods of surveillance prior to these events. And in all cases, you know, these groups that conducted these attacks always visited these locations, especially in a CCA event.
Yeah, absolutely. As a matter of fact, you know, reflecting back on the Paris incident, I remember reading a situation when the terrorists were developing the triacetone triperoxide, and some of that material was actually leaking through the roof in the apartment down below, and that individual never reported it, which may have been the key to thwarting that major attack. So, you know, the general mantra is, if it doesn't look right to you, just tell someone. Tell someone from the state and local government. Let them figure it out. But at least you've done your due diligence. That's a key piece. Many eyes and ears out there. We count on you.
Sure. Has there been any attacks in the U.S. That could be defined as a complex coordinated attack?
Yeah. So this is a unique conversation. According to my research, no. Not according to the guardrails of the definition, but we can view some of these incidents as CCA-ish, and therefore we should not discount them. Again, I mentioned before, certainly 9/11 is a coordinated attack, but doesn't fit the definition. But from a 30,000-foot view level, not fitting into this round hole is less important than being able to effectively respond and maintain this resilience during and well after the attack. So to look at examples such as the Columbine school shooting, there the attackers, which were the students, used gas, IEDs, and improvised explosive devices, as well as firearms. So those are three weapon systems. We can look at Pulse nightclub. Granted, the attacker only used a firearm, but the attacker also mentioned IEDs, which actually threw the first responders off, and they started preparing for an improvised explosive device. And then also San Bernardino, that those attackers used IEDs and firearms. And there's other examples out there. And again, you know, do we call them complex coordinated attacks? Does it really matter? Or is it more the idea of kind of learning from these complex type of incidents, particularly from the coordination piece of it, and actually extracting some of the lessons learned? But one thing is for certain, you know, all of these have resulted in many injuries and deaths. They also involve the whole of community. And they also remind us how vulnerable soft targets really are.
Sure. Yeah, that makes perfect sense. What can businesses do as we start to wrap up here? We like to talk about exercises at PreparedX. What can businesses do on the exercise front? Obviously, these types of scenarios may be relevant to some organizations if they're in high populated areas or high profile locations that may be deemed, locations that are attractive to, you know, to terrorist organizations and others that want to, you know, carry out these events. So but talk to me a little bit about, you know, the importance of exercises as it relates to businesses either working with their first responders or at least having a plan themselves to make sure that they can have a response mechanism in place.
Yeah, this is a great one, particularly from the leadership standpoint. Again, this is what I added in my recommendations and findings in my thesis, which, you know, leadership within, you name it, state and local or business, really is going to drive the success of this exercise. So you know, in response to your question, I would say, you know, this piece is extremely important, not only from exercising a policy standpoint and procedures, but also looking at it from a tabletop perspective or a discussion of a policy, or just engaging with your local first responders. I would challenge you to do that. We do tabletops all the time in my profession. Every time we find something that's either outdated, incorrect, or is questionable, but it also really kind of speaks to how we are really going to do things in a specific type of situation, whether it's a hurricane or whether it's a terrorist attack. So planning for those and exercising the planned and unplanned events with, again, I keep using this word, the whole of community in the room with you at the leadership level is extremely important. There are plenty of case studies out there from emergency responders or communities that have done exercises on a regular basis that are questioned the norm, that have addressed policies that are going to make them better prepared, more resilient. And after the incident, they have flourished. I really use the Paris 2015 attack as that. They had, you know, two major plans, the white plan and the red plan. Their citizens really stepped up afterwards and really started engaging with these exercises to then be a part of the situation. So very important to engage. And really, it's again, I mentioned before, but starting a discussion with your local government. And many times, you know, we don't think of all businesses as an integral piece of the pie here, but reach out to them and say, look, this is what I need. This is what I'd like to do. Because in effect, you know, CCAs are not just a federal, state, or local issue. No one government has the resources, time, money, capacity, or experience to develop the power for this domestic conversation, or even global conversation. So it really results in not only multi-government, but multi-community collaboration.
Excellent. Excellent. Great way to end off the podcast there. Wonderful episode. I really appreciate your time today, Jared. Any final comments for our listeners as well? If they want to reach out and contact you, how can they get a hold of you?
Yeah, the best way to reach me is through email. It's jared.goff, G-O-F-F, 10 at gmail.com. Please reach out if you have any questions or comments or added value to what I shared today. I'm more than willing to share my thesis or resources. If you have a gap, I can get you in contact with at least some of my colleagues. But Rob, I thank you for the time. This is a very important topic, and I really appreciate you reaching out to me to have me do this.
No problem. Again, we appreciate your time today. I know you're busy, so have a wonderful weekend, and we'll be in touch again soon. Thanks, Jared.
Thank you, sir.
Take care. That wraps up episode 49 of the PreparedX podcast. If you liked it, please rate us on iTunes. It's really important, or wherever else you're listening to that via the other podcast outlets. Or if you can leave a comment, if you're listening to this via our website, please leave a comment under this podcast. That's really important. Provide us with your feedback. Did you enjoy this podcast? Would you like different types of information? Would you yourself be interested in being interviewed as it relates to preparedness? Just let us know. Add your comments. Reach out to us. It's really important. We will have a special 50th edition of our podcast, so look out for that. And again, thanks for listening in today, and have a safe day.